Hi, and welcome to Demand and Desire. I'm Jez Frampton, Global CEO of Interbrand, and you're now in part two of this three-part Demand and Desire on Best Global Brands 2011 from the New York Stock Exchange. And in this part of the podcast, I'm talking to Joe Tripodi, Coca-Cola's Chief Commercial and Marketing Officer. We've always been absolutely clear on why we produce the Best Global Brand List every year. When we started putting asset values on brands, the purpose of doing the list has been simple: to inform companies that brands are valuable economic assets, and more to the point, to actually demonstrate how, if you can understand how your brand works, you can actually make it work harder for you. We're delighted that over time, the Best Global Brands List has become one of the top three rankings in the world for chief executives, along with the Fortune 500 and the best companies to work for. This year's event was bigger than ever. We had events in nine major cities around the world, and at the New York Stock Exchange, ourselves, the New York Stock Exchange and the Wall Street Journal hosted a number of events, the first of which was a discussion between myself, the Wall Street Journal, and Joe Tripodi, the Chief Commercial and Marketing Officer of Coca-Cola, an old friend of Demand and Desire. So, how does the number one brand stay at number one? And more to the point, where do they go from here?
Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Marissa Riccardi, and I run global marketing, branding, and event management here at NYC Euronext. This is our third time hosting the Executive Marketing Summit in partnership with the Wall Street Journal. This year, we're also excited to include Interbrand as part of our daily festivities. Jez Frampton, the global CEO of Interbrand, this morning helped open the markets for us. They introduced and announced their best 100 global brand list. And I have to say, we're also thrilled to have two of the great brands participating in the day events, specifically Howard Schultz from Starbucks and Joe Tripodi from the Coca-Cola Company. So welcome to you and to the rest of the guests.
Please welcome Global Chief Executive Officer of Interbrand, Jez Frampton, and Executive Vice President and Chief Marketing and Commercial Officer for the Coca-Cola Company, Joseph Tripodi. Interviewing Mr. Frampton and Mr. Tripodi is the Wall Street Journal's Simon Constable.
As you can probably hear from my voice, I wasn't born in Brooklyn. So when I think of Coke, I think of America. What do you think of when you're marketing Coke around the world?
The reason we survive is the ability to stay relevant, and particularly culturally relevant, and build around the essence of the brand around optimism, positivity, happiness. Not necessarily Americanness. Some people interpret it that way, but our long-term success will be if Coke is Chinese in China.
Your boss basically was saying that China is friendlier to businesses than the U.S. is, but the U.S. also has some values with regard to human rights and working conditions.
For an American overseas or an American traveling in Africa and they go into a remote village and find a Coca-Cola, that's their little touch of Americana. We are not overtly pushing America when we market this product around the world, okay. I can tell you that.
And is that the right way to go?
Well, I'd agree with Joe completely. I think we call the list create every year the best global brands, and Coca-Cola is at the top of that because I think it is genuinely a global brand. When you've got it right, it doesn't really matter where you come from. I think a number of brands very successfully leverage their heritage. You know, companies like BMW and Audi sort of leverage their Germanness along the way, particularly Audi with their end line. But it's not really, doesn't really matter where you come from. It matters whether you feel at home where you are.
Number one, man. Yeah. Congratulations. You must be very thrilled.
We're humbled by this.
Nice red, silver, black bottles there. Where do you go from number one?
On consumption on a per capita basis. So, for example, how many 8 ounces of Coca-Cola are consumed by a person per year? The top of the tables, the league tables, would be Mexico at 400 Cokes a year. So that means everyone in Mexico is drinking at least one Coca-Cola a day. So, you know, the global average is only 85. Our per caps in China might be 30. In India, they might be 2.
Right.
So we look at it as a land of opportunity primarily by three macro factors. One, massive urbanization. Mm-hmm. We think in the next 10 years about 800 million people are going to move into cities. I can tell you personally, I lived in Hong Kong in the early 1980s. 20% of China lived in the cities then. 47% of China lives in the cities now. 300 million people have gone into the cities.
Is the urbanization important because of the need to refrigerate? Is that what it is? Do you think that these can be drunk? Jez and I, I'm sure, drank these warm when we were kids, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
It's true, right? We're in Britain. It's true.
Everything's warm, even the beer.
Even the beer. But I mean, is that for you, though? Obviously, you sell it in Britain without chilling it, but you're saying basically you like to have stuff chilled, and that's the way...
That would be the optimal how we would serve and present our product for mostly all our products. But we would say the other big trend is middle class development. We think that over the next 10 years, probably almost 1 billion people will enter the middle class. When people get more money and then they get move into cities, their life changes. It gets faster. They're looking for packaged convenience and packaged beverages more.
When something's everywhere, how do you keep it fresh?
The fastest growing brand on our league table this year was Apple. 58% increase in brand value, tremendous performance. Everybody loves their products. They continuously innovate in terms of their product. It's easy for them because they're creating something completely new every single week virtually. Joe's selling us the same thing. I mean, he'll tell you that they don't mess with the formula. They tried it once and it didn't really go too well. So they stick with what they've got, and therefore the innovation has to happen around the product. That comes down to really understanding your market, understanding your brand, and making sure that you execute in a way that's relevant in every market.
Okay, so understand the brand, but also the world changes.
Absolutely.
So one of the things pointed to by politicians in this country, notably this city, is sugary drinks and the effect on children.
Sure.
Now, going down in size, a reaction to that in part?
For a very long time, we were just basically in three packages, a 2-liter straight wall bottle, a 20-ounce plastic PET bottle, and a 12-ounce can. And I think what we wanted was to offer a lot more choice through size variants. You're certainly going to see a lot more smaller sizes simply because that's what people are calling for.
So, problem for marketing consultant, how do you take down the volume and keep your pricing power? Because the packaging still costs a lot, and it isn't proportionate to its size either.
Yeah. This is where brands come in. If he takes the Coca-Cola name and the shape of the pack off of there and you're just left with the liquid and you don't know where it's from, you get a very different response in terms of what people are prepared to pay and what they think it stands for. So brands, if they're built properly, enable you to charge a consistent premium over time, that you are chose positively because you are who you are, not because you just happen to be there, and that people will continue to choose you over time, which are the three things that we look at in our methodology.
And Simon, let me give you an example from a previous life when I was head of marketing for Seagram in the liquor industry. The thing that amazed me was a colorless, odorless, tasteless liquid became a global phenomenon. I'm talking about Absolut vodka, and people would pay a premium for that vodka. That taught me the value and the power of brand is incredible. If you can burn into the consumer's mind certain images of what that represents and what that stands for. And there's a brand that was built without traditional mass media, very different than getting on and advertising heavily on television. So it was done basically through a print campaign, and on-premise.
So let's talk about campaigns.
Sure.
The web versus TV. Clearly, Coke's done very well using TV. What about just the web? Is the web come of age for marketers?
The point is understanding what message you're trying to get across and then understanding what might be the best possible way to do it. And I think whereas 20 years ago, the options available to people like Joe and other people who are trying to build brands around the world were relatively limited. Now the options are manifold. And the challenge, I guess, for anybody is to work out what's the best way to do it. How do I use the web? How do I use Twitter running around us right now? How do I use Facebook? How do I use traditional TV advertising? It's about understanding how it all comes together from a communication perspective.
One of the things about the TV, it seems that there's like some knowledge of who's watching, but not a whole lot. And with the web, we know who's watching, where they're watching, how old they are, what their address is, more or less, and how long they've watched it, and whether they clicked off when Fonzie jumped the shark or whatever. They know that exactly at that moment. And yet it seems that marketers are not piling headlong into the web in the way that you'd have thought when they suddenly are given all that information that they said they'd been craving for decades.
Well, you know, when I kind of grew up in the world of marketing, there was this thing called direct mail when they used to put things through your letterbox. Do you remember that? And the whole idea was that it was measurable.
Yeah.
So people liked it, but then they realized that it had a role to play. And there were certain things that it was good at and certain things that it was not so good at. I think the difference between that medium and what's going on with digital and the web is that the ability to build relationships with people, the ability to have conversations, and now, of course, we're starting to really see the connection of text, comment, perspective, video, all of these things coming together. I mean, I think we're still at the beginning of what this really means to marketing and how it might work. And again, you know, Joe's involved in this every single day. I'm sure he has
We absolutely are at the beginning of this journey. It's a long journey. And I think when you get into a very large global business system, it would not be wise or prudent to move all your resources onto one thing. You know, it was just like the hysteria that occurred 10 or 15 years ago that, you know, everybody was going to buy all their groceries through online and Peapod, right? And you went to one extreme. Consumers don't change that quickly. And so you have to be very measured and lean into these new opportunities. When you have a business like ours that has been built, you know, for so many years on consistent investment, on a certain type of investment, you're not going to completely abandon that, throw the baby out with the bathwater, and chase the next shiny object. It wouldn't make a lot of sense.
But
having said that, you need to be leaning in. And so we think about a model at Cope that we call 70-20-10. 70% of your investment in those areas that we know drive the greatest value and are pretty have given us the payoff we want. 20% innovating off the 70%. And then 10% that we ring fence and say, let's experiment. Let's try new stuff. If we fail, that's fine. Fail is a good thing. The thing that's the bad thing is if we fail at the same thing in 25 countries, then we haven't scaled the learning from the failure. And so it's that managing and entering that and leaning into the social media or the new media at an appropriate pace as opposed to saying, I'm changing everything now. But it is important
to
be media agnostic, my point, Simon. To be media agnostic and to allocate your resources against where are the people, where are the consumers, where do you get them?
You said people don't change that quickly, but when they do change, it can come very quickly and hit a company very hard.
Absolutely.
Like the bookselling business has been devastated very quickly. Amazon was selling books, and then they were doing the Kindle, and it was really sort of a nothing clunky device that I wouldn't be seen dead with. And then suddenly all the bookstores are out of business.
Right. That's disintermediation through technology. I'm not yet seeing that level of disintermediation in the beverage business, given
You can't remix your own in quite the same way, can you? How do you take a brand like Coke or another mass market brand, premium price maybe, and continue to succeed in times that are tough for many, many people, not just in this country, but all around the world?
There is a ton of evidence that shows that if you continue to build your brand, and I'm not talking about communications here, because brands are built through your environments, your people, your products and services, and your communications. It's everything that you do. If you continue to innovate, continue to develop, continue to deliver to your audience, the chances are you will come out in a much better position than the people that you're competing with. So number one, our advice would be, and we take our own advice, is continue to build your brand no matter what is going on around you, because it is fundamentally one of the most valuable assets you own and an extremely important point of differentiation and competitive strength. So you abandon that at your peril. There's a funny thing about downturns, actually. They have a very interesting habit of shaking out markets. You can see it in the car market, probably more innovation over the last 5 years than we've seen in the previous 50.
Your actual capitalist believes in creative destruction. This is great.
I'd much rather things continue to go up. But I do think that you gave me specifically a situation where things could get worse. And I think two pieces of advice. Number one, stick at it.
Stick at it.
Because if you don't, the chances are somebody else is. And the second thing is do not stop innovating. Because again, people continue to change. They adapt to their new context. Slightly tougher times. Okay, you need to make sure in Joe's case that he's got the right pack sizes, he's got the right positioning,
Can you think of any one, and let's leave Coke out of this, but other companies where they've got complacent and they have stopped innovating and then basically just dropped the ball and left the goal wide open for someone to just dribble the ball up, kick it in the back of the net?
The fast growers in our table this year are people like Apple, Amazon, Google, Samsung. Burberry, interesting, but that's another story. The ones that are going down, interestingly, there's just as many in the electronic space, companies like Sony, Nokia, Nintendo. Now, there's something about the way that those companies are operating, their degree of connection to their customer, the clarity of understanding about what role they play in their marketplace, really what their brand is about, and then about delivering and executing a product, a service, environments, whatever else you need to do in order to create something that's genuinely desirable by consumers. You know, the rules don't change. It's pretty simple stuff. Make things that people desperately want and wrap it in a brand that they can't live without.
I did desperately want that, but he already started it. So this is about creating the future and seeing the future, and I'm told that the best way to see the future is to create it for yourself. What are you doing to create a different future, a better future for your brands going forward? Like, what can we expect in 10 years' time, in 5 years' time, next week, whatever it is?
I think that's a great question, Simon. I think, first of all, I would say that the operating environment for large global enterprises now is more complex than ever. And you remember the Jim Collins book, seminal book, The Good to Great, and he talked a lot about the genius of the ant, how you've got to balance these two things that are inherently in contradiction. You know, you've got to be global, but you've got to be local. You've got, in our case, we're trying to double our business in 10 years, what took 125 years, but in a sustainable way. There's all of these inherent contradictions that we live with all the time. We have to be great storytellers, but we have to scale. We have to be going after teens, because everyone knows that's teens, that's the future. But there's huge adult populations going up around the world. We have to be great inspirational marketers, but we have to be great operational marketers. Balancing all of these counteracting forces is a real challenge for us. When we look out as to how we're going to reinvent and continue to reinvent our future, you know, when we think about innovation, we're just not thinking about what's in the bottle, irrespective of we have 500 brands, 3,000 products, probably 12,000 SKUs. It's more about, yes, product innovation, packaging innovation, equipment innovation, which it gets to, and then all types of consumer engagement innovation. How do you get to consumers, whether it's digital, mobile, or whatever? We are looking at all of those. We fundamentally think, though, regardless of those, we have a philosophy we call liquid and linked. So regardless of what we're doing, we want to make sure that the idea, the powerful idea, has to sit right there at the center. And you have to be able to, it has to be liquid, and it has to be able to go to all of these different endpoints. Some of them be digital, some will be analog.
What's the powerful idea at the center of this then? Just to remind us.
Open happiness.
Open.
Hope is Coca-Cola, as a Coca-Cola brand. Coca-Cola is kind of, I would say the idea is Coca-Cola is an antidote to modern day woe, at least as we stand currently.
Things, when they're produced in the marketing department, they sit on the table and the marketers will stand around and say, yes, we can produce this. And yet when you go to buy it, like when I go to buy a Coke, it's typically in one of the delis in the bottom of a cooler. The cooler's sort of got sort of grime around it and stuff like that. And so how much of a problem is that for a company with its brand?
I mean, I think I'll let Joe answer it specifically about Coke, because he's the commercial guy as well as the marketing guy.
But you know where I'm coming from.
I know exactly where you're coming
channel
from.
Of distribution.
The medium is the message, as they used to say. And the channel is as much the message as the medium might be. So if you take somebody like Samsung, for instance, when they decided that they were going to go full on after Sony about 15, 20 years ago, the first thing that they did was they looked very hard at their distribution strategy, and they took a very difficult decision. They came out of Walmart because they knew that it wasn't actually enabling them to create the premium price position that they wanted to, or the premium perception position that they wanted to. So sometimes you have to make difficult decisions. Mm. Now, you know, it's very different world selling flat screen televisions and mobile phones from selling beverages in multiple CTNs in virtually every country in the world. But at the end of the day, you know, every brand should be seeking to make sure that the environment in which it is purchased and consumed reflects the values of the brand itself. And I'm sure that one of the things that the teams at Coca-Cola will be doing is trying to make sure that the product isn't sitting at the bottom of moldy fridges, and indeed talking very carefully to those distributors who might be allowing that.
But you'll acknowledge that does happen,
absolutely.
Though.
Absolutely, and you know, I think there are inherent challenges. It's the law of large numbers. When you have 13 million pieces of equipment, coolers, vending machines. You know, we have 987,000 vending machines in Japan. You know, can I tell you that every one of those is perfectly merchandised and clean? Probably in Japan they are, but in other markets probably no. And so there are, but that's why, you know, Coke is one of the largest employers in the world. It's certainly the largest employer in the continent of Africa. And it uses very, very different and unique distribution methods, many of them trying to employ, for example, giving entrepreneurial opportunities to women. How we're going to reinvent ourselves is very much along the sustainability line, in the sustainability area, to make sure that we can grow and double our business, but do it in a sustainable way. If we don't do that, then people are not going to buy our products.
So, and this must have a lot to do with water being a key ingredient there. Now, yes. Africa, there's a lot of water problems.
Yes,
there's not enough water where it needs to be.
I think fundamentally we believe that unless you have a stable society, a functioning society, you're not going to have a business, right? And so as a consequence, we've made very specific commitments to NGOs in the instance of water with World Wildlife Fund that we will put back and deliver as much water as we consume. And we'll reach that goal by, I believe it's 2015 or 2016. In addition, we've got, I would say, literally 250 projects around the world in water-stressed areas, particularly Africa, India would be another example, where we actively work to revive an aquifer if it's not live, to help drill the wells and ensure that we are becoming, that we are fully responsible members of the community. If we're not doing that, then we're not going to survive as a business. Because we believe fundamentally you can do well by doing good. And we've got a very aggressive program we call 5 by 20. 5 million women entrepreneurs by 2020. AIDS, HIV, AIDS education, condom distribution through our trucks, et cetera. All of these things that we want to be a responsible global citizen.
And a big part of that is putting in on your global supply chain.
Yeah.
Do you see companies bringing their production close to where they're going to sell it in the future as part of a marketing strategy simply because those chains were getting so long?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think to a degree it depends on which sector you're looking at. So certain sectors you might see some of these trends, and in others it makes more sense to have large regional distribution. It really does depend on the nature of your product and the nature of the markets you're serving and the degree to which there is change in the product by the time it actually reaches the users in market. I guess there's a couple of points here, one of which is to do with the speed of innovation. The change in the way that the markets operate around businesses now, and when I say markets, I'm talking about us, consumers. Mm. We are so joined up now, and as an individual, we now have the power to hold whole companies to account. And we've seen that several times over the last decade, and particularly as social network has increased in capability, you've seen companies literally being held to account by consumers. Now, this changes the relative relationship between companies and markets. And also, going along with that, is an increase in the wave of, shall we say, demand from what people want and what they expect from companies. I think one of the things that's going to force companies to look at their supply chains is quite simply they're going to have to move a lot faster to actually meet the needs of markets. Now, one of the big problems with most companies is that they're still built around structures that were created in the Industrial Revolution or the creation of, you know, mass production, top-down management, silo mentalities, disconnection between one department and another, very difficult to get anything to change, whereas markets are now moving very, very quickly.
It's registering everyone in the room.
You need to be able to operate across that. So you need horizontal management decision-making, not vertical management decision-making. So, you know, regardless of supply chain, I think that's one of the biggest issues that companies have to deal with. And going along with that, you need to be able to get to market fast. That means you need the production in the right place, the materials in the right place at the right time, and the right length of supply chain in order to meet it. Big, big issues going forward.
So that's it for part two of Demand and Desire's three-parter from our Best Global Brands 2011 event at the New York Stock Exchange. Up next, one of the most fascinating stories from this year's top 100. Out of the top five risers this year, four were high-tech brands, but one was a luxury brand. In the final part of this special edition of Demand and Desire, we get the opportunity to hear from the amazing Angela Ahrens, who's the Chief Executive Officer at Burberry.